Welcome to New World Notes. This week we'll have part two of Orwell Rolls in His Grave, drastically condensed by yours truly. Orwell gets connected to two media issues today, the low information value of most programming, and how deregulation causes monopoly, causes suppression of news stories that don't advance our ruler's agenda. And here we go.
You have this contracting of ambition about what should be covered and what the public has right to know about. The price of power in Washington, who really makes money and who really benefits from the decisions.
You have reached the stage in American politics, and I'm not kidding you, where the issue is not a debate over ideas. You have a point of view, I have a point of view. Who should that person support? That's what democracy is about. The issue is whether ideas at all matter. You look like a nice fellow. Nice wife. You have any kids?
Yeah, two.
Okay. Why wouldn't I want to vote for you?
Tony Benn, former member of British Parliament.
One of the strange things about it is that politics is now presented in terms of politicians and not politics. I don't think the media are interested in politics. They're interested in politicians, which is a wholly different subject.
Media corporations don't cover the news when it comes to politics anymore. The political news coverage in 2000 was half what it was in 96. 96 was half what it was in 92. The third leading source of revenue for the media today, broadcast media, happens to be political ads. So if you're a politician, the only way you get heard is with ads. In 1981, the media was getting $80 million from political campaigns for ads. Today, the last campaign, they got $1 billion. That's why you've got to have millions of dollars to run for office as a politician. You're either a millionaire, you're able to raise large sums of money all day, dolling for dollars, and that's who goes into politics. And you are complicit in this system. You're not going to rock the boat.
You know, 98% of those who run for Congress, who run again, get elected, get reelected. We have a 98% return rate in Congress. Are you aware of this? You know, I looked up the statistic. The old Soviet Politburo had a 92% return rate. Right? They actually have more turnover than we have in the U.S. Congress. Is that just the most embarrassing thought? Why do we do this? We've got to change these laws.
We grant these monopoly rights to TV stations. They don't pay a penny to the people for getting these monopoly rights to TV frequencies. Then they turn around and sell time on the public property and make billions of dollars and destroy our political system. All the while, they pay off the politicians themselves to keep getting these monopoly rights. The corruption here is dreadful.
The public is really at a loss. What do you do about that exactly? I'm not quite sure. I mean, they're probably in a perfect world, there should be a citizens' movement about this. People should be marching in the streets. I mean, in some ways, we should be as angry about what's happened to our media as the Russians ought to be about what happened to their media. Now, that would be seen as heresy inside the networks. How dare you? We covered stories all the time last week. Look at this story. Look at that story. They would take issue with what I just said.
They'd probably call you un-American.
They would call me un-American and a bomb thrower, and I probably won't be on any of their airwaves anymore after this interview.
Danny Schechter, December 2001.
10 years ago, 50 companies ran the media in America. Now it's down to 5 to 7. Today, tonight, as I came down here, NPR was reporting on decisions that the FCC, under the control of Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, who when asked about whether or not there was a digital divide in the world, said, "I'm more worried about the Mercedes divide. I'd like to have one, but I can't afford it." That's the commissioner of the FCC, who is about to lift all the ownership caps on big media companies, and an issue that is not covered in the media.
Michael Powell was actually quoted as saying that he has no idea what the public interest is. The oppressor here is regulation. He actually said that. Starting with Ronald Reagan, the holy grail of deregulation has been sold to the public, and the news media has largely ignored its disastrous results.
Once the Reagan administration was done, there were more rules, but they called it deregulation. It's almost this Orwellian use of language where you create new rules, but the rules change because they benefit industry, and you call it deregulation. and you say deregulation, and people feel that's good because people like deregulation. People like fewer rules. They like, you know, depending on simpler, cleaner, you know, old Western rules. But it's a trick. It's not really what's happening.
Jim Ryan, TV anchor, Fox, Good Day, New York.
I remember when I first went into television, I believe the FCC rules were very stringent about how many television stations a network could own. I think it was 5. And, of course, they had to be in different markets. And now, I know here in New York, we're talking about a duopoly. That's the new word. You have the probability, it looks like right now, that News Corporation will be the owners of The Post, Channel 9, and Channel 5 in the one New York marketplace. So, yeah, the regulations have eased considerably. The whole ball game has changed, and precisely how that affects different people buying and selling different stations in different markets and how it impacts on the news, I don't know.
In my view, there are tremendous effects that are almost entirely negative. There's almost nothing positive about it. First of all, it leads to these companies are so big, their political power grows exponentially.
It's a democratic issue. It means that one viewpoint will come to dominate in most of the outlets that we use for knowing what's going on in the world.
Many people are not aware that when you watch television, you are watching a program produced by a large multinational corporation that has enormous conflicts of interest.
General Electric and NBC is a perfect example. How can we be sure we're going to get the kind of information we need to have about the nuclear industry, about defense contracts, and all of those things when NBC is beholden to this parent company? Why would they report on that? Of course they wouldn't. Why would ABC report on what's going on at Disney? They wouldn't. There's no point in it. And it's precisely for that reason that those companies want to own television stations in the first place, so that they can keep a check on those sorts of things.
General Electric has made it a very proud part of their policies that they are going to move jobs from the United States of America to China, to Mexico, any place in the world where they can get cheap labor. This suggests, obviously, that General Electric is deeply concerned about our trade policies. Over the years, General Electric has done its best not to pay taxes or to pay as little as they can in taxes, taking advantage of all kinds of corporate welfare tax loopholes. Suggests very strongly that General Electric has an interest in tax policy. General Electric is a major polluter. Therefore, they're concerned about weakening environmental policies. It's not obviously just General Electric. It's the same thing with CBS or ABC. The conflicts of interest are enormous, and the result is that certain issues are talked about, certain issues are not talked about.
In close to 11 years, we've done more than 100 reports. The reports and investigations about public servants screwing up or systemic abuses of public trust by public officials almost always get covered. We're the ones that broke the Lincoln bedroom scandal about the Clinton White House. We've done a lot of this kind of thing. When we do those stories, they get covered, and the media jumps on them, frankly. We have a news conference. We normally have 50 or 60 reporters, 4 or 5 cameras. But I have to tell you, when we've investigated corporations, for some reason, it just doesn't get covered. What can I say?
I did a Business Week cover a short while ago. The majority of Americans believe that corporate America is just one corrupt institution that needs to be reined in.
In some ways, corporate power is treated by our news media much like communism is treated by the Soviet press. You know, in the Soviet media, the bad commissar who didn't meet the tractor quota could be skewered in the media. Pravda or TASS could give the guy a hard time. But the system of communism is off limits. And in many respects, the occasional capitalist or firm that might make a bad tire or bad seatbelt can be skewered. But the system as a whole is always off limits.
In my entire political life, not one reporter has ever come up to me and said, Bernie, you know, the average worker is today working longer hours for low wages than 25 years ago. What the hell are you doing about that? Why do people have to work 50 or 60 hours a week? Bernie, what are you going to do about the plants that are being shut down in Vermont where companies are moving to China? What are you going to do about that, Bernie? Never been asked to me.
Why not?
because those are questions that the reporters are not allowed to think about. You want, in a sense, you know, people say, well, do you think, Bernie, that there's a conspiracy, that Jack Welch is on the phone to every reporter for NBC telling them what to ask? Of course not. But what goes on, there's a framework of thought that you are allowed to have, and it goes from here, it goes to there.
And everybody kind of has the same mindset, you know.
Joe Klein's executive producer, Fox News at 10.
This story plays, this is a lead because it, you know, it screams. This is a, you know, everybody kind of has the same approach to it.
Mark Crispin Miller.
Everybody knows about Enron and how the guys at the top managed to cash out very handsomely while preventing the pensioners from withdrawing their money in time to prevent complete ruin, financial ruin. Well, I mean, there's a history behind this, you know. George Bush, who is, of course, a good friend of Kenneth Lay, cashed out in exactly the same way, you know, as a major shareholder in Harkin.
According to the Center for Public Integrity, George Bush served on the Harkin Energy's board and was able to realize a huge profit of $848,000 by selling his stock in the corporation. Harkin had concealed its losses by selling some of the firm's assets to a group of insiders and declaring a profit. Shortly after he sold, the stock price plummeted. He reported the sale to the SEC 34 weeks late. Bush was on the audit committee and the restructuring committee. He claimed he didn't know.
I propose some tough new standards for corporate reform. Like you all, I took a look out there and saw a problem. And the problem was we had some folks who were trying to fudge the numbers. We had some people who decided they weren't going to tell the truth when it came to their assets and liabilities.
The Harkin inside trading story was reported by the Center for Public Integrity 7 months before the presidential election, but the mainstream media chose not to report the story.
This represents a kind of insider trading. It's obviously epidemic at the top.
In the 2000 election campaign, the mainstream news media hinted that Al Gore was a liar. At the same time, the press ignored or glossed over serious questions about George Bush. From repeated allegations that he had gone AWOL to inside trading. Is there a connection between Bush's avowed policy to completely deregulate big media and their See No Evil news coverage? Call it a coincidence.
You know, they'll cover whatever they damn well please, and it's not going to get in the way of the bottom line. It's not going to cost a lot of money to produce, and it's generally not going to upset the powers that be, of which they are a major part themselves. And that's where we are as a country, and it's really grim to watch. It's very depressing.
Bush made millions of dollars as governor of Texas, and his father is now making millions of dollars as a worker for Carlisle, making millions of dollars thanks to the policies of his son. His son has all around him in the White House and throughout the government all kinds of people from Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin's making out like a bandit because of the war on terrorism. This is a scandal of such magnitude, you know, that you'd think that the press would be thanking its lucky stars that it happened on their watch, because it's such a great story. No, it's too big for them to cover.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. And their speech is growing increasingly unkind. And they say they are Christ's disciples. They don't look like Jesus to me. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland. We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. They'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors. And we call ourselves the advanced civilization. That sounds like crap to me. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got high school kids running around in Calvin Klein and Guess, who cannot pass a sixth grade written test. But if you ask them, they can tell you name of every crotch on MTV. Living in the wasteland of the free. We kill for oil, then we throw a party when we win. Some guy refuses to fight, and we call that the sin. And he's standing up for what he believes in. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Where I'm poor and I've become the enemy. Let's blame our troubles on the weak one. Sounds like some kind of Hitler remedy. Living in the wasteland of the free. While we sit gloating in our greatness, justice is sent to the bottom of the sea. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free.
Iris Dement singing Wasteland of the Free. Since this week's show focuses a lot on television, one can't help thinking of the speech given to the National Association of Broadcasters in 1961 by Newton Minow, former FCC chair. Here, Minow famously called TV programming a vast wasteland. The phrase instantly caught on, and it remains well known. Here's a TV trivia question. In the mid-60s, a small part of that wasteland was a series called Gilligan's Island. What was the name of the ship that turned the cast into castaways on that island? It was the SS Minow, sarcastically named after Newton. A quick history review before returning to Orwell rolls in his grave. In 1979, the U.S.-backed tyrant, the Shah of Iran, was overthrown. When the U.S. agreed to admit him, the Iranians got annoyed and held 52 employees of the U.S. embassy hostage for 444 days, it turns out. At least three were later confirmed as CIA operatives. Each day, the dim witness news on TV proclaimed something like, "America held hostage, day 279. The continuing hostage crisis, quote-unquote, was clobbering President Carter in the polls. Carter and the media vilified Iranians, and especially their new head of state, the Ayatollah Khomeini. At the same time, Carter was negotiating with the Iranians to free the hostages, offering to sell them arms, in violation of U.S. law. At the same time, an American private citizen was also negotiating with Iran. This was Ronald Reagan, through envoys including campaign manager William Casey and George Herbert Walker Bush. These allegations are published in a book by Carter administration official Gary Sick. Reagan offered the Iranian government a better arms deal if they would agree not to release the hostages until after the U.S. elections. The Iranians accepted Reagan's offer and began receiving arms and replacement parts, shipped from Israel, almost immediately. The hapless Carter lost the election, Reagan won, and Iran released the hostages 20 minutes after Reagan was sworn in as president, on January 20, 1981. If the allegations are correct, before and during his first term, Ronald Reagan committed felonies that were not only clearly impeachable offenses, but probably treason. In any case, something was rotten in the state of Denmark, as it were. The press knew some of what happened, but a story was never published or broadcast until many years later. First, the story wasn't newsworthy. Later, it was old news, just like the stolen election of 2000, which we'll hear about next week and which also got no news coverage. Let's get back to part two of Orwell Rolls in His Grave.
We know what to do with someone caught misappropriating funds, but when confronted with evidence of a systematic attempt to undermine the political system itself, we recoil in a general failure of imagination and nerve.
Gary Sick, an American diplomat, wrote a book called The October Surprise, in which he argued that the Reagan team seems to have basically meddled in the situation to make sure that the hostages didn't get released before Election Day.
Gary Sick was a member of the Carter administration and on the staff of the National Security Council from August 1976 to April 1981. According to Mr. Sick's congressional testimony, quote, "In the course of hundreds of interviews in the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East, I have been told repeatedly that individuals associated with the Reagan-Bush campaign of 1980 met secretly with Iranian officials to delay the release of the American hostages until after the presidential election. For this favor, Iran was rewarded with a substantial supply of arms from Israel." End quote. According to Mr. Sick, low-level intelligence operatives and arms dealers are no Boy Scouts. End quote. Their accounts were not identical, but on the central facts, they were remarkably consistent. Because of my past government experience, I knew about certain events that could not possibly be known to most of the sources. Yet their stories confirm these facts. Again, quoting Gary Sick, "From October 15th to October 20th, 1980, events came to a head in a series of meetings in Paris. Accounts of these meetings vary. There is, however, widespread agreement on a number of points. 1. William Casey, Reagan's campaign manager, was a key participant. 2. Iranian representatives agreed that the hostages would not be released prior to the presidential election on November 4th. 3. In return, Israel would serve as a conduit for arms and spare parts to Iran. Quote, At least five of the sources who said they were in Paris in connection with these meetings insist that George Bush was present for at least one meeting. Three sources say they saw him there. Former President George Bush denied being in Paris. According to SICK, immediately after the Paris meetings, things began to happen. Iran publicly shifted its position in the negotiations with the Carter administration, disclaiming any further interest in receiving military equipment. Again, according to SICK, between October 21st and October 23rd, Israel sent a plane load of F-4 fighter aircraft tires to Iran in contravention of the U.S. boycott and without informing Washington.
Gary Sick, author, The October Surprise.
There was a congressional investigation into this claim eventually. It was grossly inadequate. It was a real whitewash. A lot of questions were never even entertained, much less answered.
In 1991, a congressional committee led by Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton declared there to be no credible evidence linking Reagan's team with a delay in the hostages' release. In two contemporaneous magazine articles, charges of an October surprise were discounted. According to Mr. Sick, quote, after listening to the evidence, one of the former hostages I spoke with said simply, I don't want to believe it. It's too painful to think about. Whatever the truth of the October surprise may be, what is undeniable is that the story is a career graveyard for journalists seeking to work in the corporate mainstream.
If you read what the hostages themselves had to say later in their various reminiscences of the experience, and you read some of the press coverage in depth, you find that the Iranians were guarding the hostages, had their stopwatches out. I mean, they were waiting for a particular moment to let those hostages run into the field of vision of the photographers who were all there waiting to take their picture.
Do you agree with this statement? Whatever is regularly broadcast is the definition of what is news. Or do you have another definition?
That is a good question because, if it happens but you don't hear about it, did it happen?
If the party could thrust its hand into the past and say this or that event never happened, that surely was more terrifying than mere torture or death. George Orwell, 1984.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Orwell Rolls in His Grave was written by Robert Kane Pappas, adapted for radio by Lynn Gary, and much condensed by yours truly. By all means, go listen to Gary's 90-minute original. You'll find links at my archive of New World Notes. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter, the station management staff, or the licensee, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. New World Notes can be heard by radio, by digital stream, podcast, or free MP3 download at any time. For podcast or download, just go to radioforall.net and do a search on New World Notes. That's www.radio4all.net. Even easier, just go to wwuh.org and find its description of this program. Then just click on the convenient link you'll find there, and you're ready to listen, download any show, or subscribe to a podcast. That's wwuh.org. I appreciate your comments and suggestions. Email kdowst, that's KDOWST, at hotmail.com. If you'd like to receive weekly email announcements about the next show, drop me a line. Again, that's KDOWST at hotmail.com. Until next time, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, illegitimae non carborundum, and keep the faith.